and welcome to Raising a Pro. I'm Annie Apple, journalist and NFL mom to my son, Eli Apple. And I am so excited about today's guest. Her energy stays on 100, and that's how she always keeps it. Audrey Garrett is truly a force. She's mom to Cleveland Browns defensive end, Myles Garrett, selected first overall pick of the 2017 NFL Draft. And he has been terrorizing NFL quarterbacks ever since. Audrey didn't raise no scrubs now. Her oldest son, Sean Williams, is a retired NBA player. Her daughter, Bria Garrett, was a track star in college. And of course, Myles is the man on defense in Cleveland. No subject was off limit. And yes, we talked about that infamous November day and the on-field altercation that had everyone talking. But there's so much more to Myles than meets the eye. Let's talk to his mom. Ladies and gentlemen, mom of the Myles Garrett, Audrey Garrett.
Annie, does he have to be the Myles Garrett?
Oh, like, you know, listen, he's the, what, is there another Myles Garrett out there that does what he does?
But he is an original.
Thank you. See, the-
I can only speak for the one that I have. So I will go with the, we'll go with the.
So once again, the mom of the Myles Garrett, Audrey Garrett.
And I'll say thank you very much. Thank you.
First of all, reading about Myles, we're going to get to him in a minute, but let's talk about you, Miss Track and Field star.
Oh, you've done some homework.
I've done homework because I've realized, you know, my best friend is Dawn Elliott, mother to Ezekiel Elliott. And you know, Dawn was a track and field hurdling star. So for me, I'm always amazed when I meet other moms who kids are dominant on a football field because their mama ran track.
I forgot that was Zeke's mama, because I'm a hurdler. Hey.
Yes, both of you, hurdle on.
Well, she was in a whole nother class. Let me put it like that. Though I'm an All-American, she's in a whole nother class. So we'll just, let me give props where props are due.
I mean, but props are due to you too, because you went to Hampton. When you went to Hampton, it wasn't Hampton University, it was Hampton Institute.
Why are you aging me? Yes. I'm a proud Hampton Institute attendee. But when I got my diploma, what a lot of people don't realize is I actually had the scholarship there and quit school. I didn't drop out because I was pregnant. I wanted to live in Texas. And so I followed my best friend to Texas, got married, had my oldest son, and went back to Hampton after I divorced and still didn't finish. I quit again because the window came open for me to come back to Texas. So I went back and forth for a minute, but I finally got my degree, my bachelor's in mass media communications, ironically, not until 2015. And then I got my master's right behind in 2016.
And you're working your doctorate right now.
Yes, working my doctorate in strategic leadership. So, you know, I try to talk to young people about don't quit. You know, I was 50 when I laid my hands on my first diploma. I waited till my kids finished and I was like, I'm going back to school. I promised my mother. I said, I'm going back to school. I promise. And so it was vital to me, especially when both of my sons coming out early from school, I made them promise, I need you to finish your degree. It was a promise I made to my mom. And I want them to finish. Bria has hers. We graduated 2 weeks apart with our undergrads in 2015. The two females are the only ones with their degrees in our house.
Well, let's go back to your mother of three. We have Sean. And let's get to Sean. Sean played basketball and he was drafted to New Jersey Nets. What was that like for you, you know, when Sean got drafted and he was, you know, now starting to live that professional basketball life? And then you had Bria, who was also a star, track and field. They all followed in yours, went to Texas A&M.
Right.
So tell me, what was that like before Myles even will step foot, you know, to really start his career? What was that like watching Sean do his?
There are 10 years between Sean and Myles. So when it first happened with Sean, we were just like, wow. You don't imagine your kid is going to do that. It's like a one-off, you know, the experience was like, you know, so crazy. We knew that Bria was athletic. Bria's me physically. We're built the same. And I was just like, Lord, if I could just get her to run track and field, Lord, if I could just get her, you know, that's how she started running hurdles, was I was just begging. And so when she does it and she gets her scholarship and she becomes a national champion, you know, well before there was any kind of, you know, Myles Garrett being number one. And Myles was just like, between them two, we didn't even know that Myles felt pressure to do and be the best of who he was until he did an interview in high school in his senior year. And he told the interviewer he felt pressure because of me, my husband, and Sean and Bria. He was like, I couldn't be raggedy. Like, dude, we just want you to be your best you, because he's very cerebral. And he was scrawny. See, people see that picture of him as a junior. His freshman year, he went in dorky, no muscles. It was crazy looking.
I have a question for you. At what age did Miles start playing football?
You see, there's a picture of him out there that I know I saw it on Monday Night Football or Thursday Night Football the other night, where he was in this little uniform and played for the Cannondale Wildcats. And I'm telling you, he dragged off that field and said, I don't want to play no more. It was too hot in Texas for him. And his daddy let him quit. And so he didn't go back till he was like in junior high school. So he didn't play all that, you know, Pop Warner League and for years and years and years. So, you know, it's still new to him.
So it's so funny. He was like, it's too hot for this.
Girl, it's 100-some degrees. He dragged off that little field. His helmet was dragging behind him. He had taken off his pants. And he has a little lisp. And he was like, I don't want to do this no more, Daddy. And Lawrence comes home and I'm like, you let him quit? You know, because I don't do quit. If you started a project, whether it's playing piano, Bria did cheering, whatever it is I paid money for, oh, you going to complete this. And my husband let him quit.
That baby knew it was too hot. So let's get to high school. I think one of his former teachers described him in high school as like an old soul.
Yes.
And he was a good student. But I think for him, he loved poetry, right? Mm-hmm. So it was almost like at one point he had to choose between playing football or, you know, focusing on his other first love, which was poetry. How did you guys get him, honestly, to commit to one and not the other?
We didn't. He had to understand he could still be cerebral and still be fully committed to football. And once he bought into that, he always saw himself as the next Sean Williams. And I'll never forget, I have a really good friend who's like a grandmother to them. And she said, you don't ever try to be the next anybody. Be the first Miles Garrett. And it was like a light switch went off, kind of. And he was like, I can embrace all of me. The one thing that Sean's journey has shown him is that he can be true to himself, regardless of what anybody else thinks. He can be true to himself. And their truth is different, but he can be true to himself. And that was when that light bulb went off, is when he realized he could be the first original Miles Garrett. And he just poured all his energy into that. And we supported it.
From what I read, his grandmother really helped him develop the love of poetry.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how did that, like, when did he fall in love with poetry?
Well, you know what, Gran, and not to be mistaken with the lady that I just spoke about, Gran is his actual grandmother. That's my husband's mom. And she read to him all the time when he was little. She was our caregiver for our kids till they went to school. And she just really poured into him. All the kids are poetry minded, you know, and it was something about how it was just smooth. I mean, it's just like rap music. You know how when you really get a good rap, and he liked the smoothness.
My name is Annie and I'm here to say we're going to have us a really good day like that.
Sorry. Well, you know, something along those lines.
Rap. You know what I mean? You said rap, but I had to take it back to the 80s.
Yeah, so he didn't get that here, but he liked the flow of the poetry. And he was always a voracious reader. So by the time he got to high school, it just poured into his spirit that kind of that flow of poetry.
You called Miles cerebral. Tell me, what does that mean when you call his personality cerebral?
He's a thinker. You're going to get what comes to my mind sometimes come up. I have to say, ooh, my inside voice came out to play. He thinks, oh Lord, he thinks before he talks. And when you see him pause, he's thinking. And in everything he says, he's thinking. I'm not saying he's calculated. He's thinking. And many times when I would be talking to the children, I would say, I meant what I said, but I could have said that better. He makes a point of saying whatever better before it comes out of his mouth. And so he's cerebral in the fact that if he doesn't know something, he'll research it. If he hears something, he may not say anything to you, but he'll come back and say, I was reading X And so when you said this, or if you said a word he didn't understand, he would ask you what it meant. He was all, he's a thinker, but he gets that from his dad. He gets that from his dad. His dad is very much a an introverted personality. And he really, by the time my husband opens his mouth and says anything, it's time for me to be quiet. So you want to talk to me because I'm going to give you a conversation. And Miles is the same exact way. When Miles opens his mouth, it's time for you to be quiet because he has something to say. He's thought about it. He's given careful consideration and he feels it's time for him to finally put his verbiage on something. So I don't know if how that comes out with DNA, but that's a trait he got from my husband that I'm thankful for. Let me put it like that.
There was one point in high school, Miles said that he felt lost in high school at some point because he was trying to, because like he had to almost develop the passion for football because right. He had a creative side of him. And, you know, football demands all of you, yeah. Like so much of you. So it's almost like how did you and your husband, how did you help guide him to kind of balance out where you don't have to give up the creative side, thinking side of you to play this game, but you can manage to do both?
You just said it is that you have to find that balance. And that's what we encouraged him to do. We didn't make football all encompassing for him. When you left it, you left it. I tell people all the time, they assume that I know football. I don't know football. I know what Miles does because I don't talk to him about football. I was recently in Cleveland for a game and Miles and I were getting ready to go out to dinner. And I told my husband, I said, Miles and I are getting ready to go to dinner. And he was like, I'm not invited. And I was like, so what you probably never knew is that I would always go out with the kids individually to talk to them. We don't talk football. We talk life. We talk politics. We talk in high school. We talked what was going on in the classroom. We did stuff where I tried to communicate there was life outside of football. You talk football with everybody else. And I think that's a mistake that people make with their kids. They get so geeked up themselves that their son is playing or, you know, whatever it is your kid's sport is. But in this particular instance, Miles, that they forget to nurture those other pieces. And I think a lot of times you get to the end of a career when they do make it successfully and they don't know anything or have any other interests outside of football. And you have to grow your whole person. A football is just a piece of who he is. So when he said, you know, after the season that he considered, you know, retirement, he had plan B, plan C, plan D, because his life is not the totality of football. So you have to nurture those things that come outside of football. It shouldn't be the totality of what your kid is doing.
That is so true. I know for Eli and I know Eli, his love language is football. Like if I go to a game, I'm watching a game. I know the game. I love the game. So after the game, it's like, okay, what happened on this play? We're watching it. You know, so we go through different defenses, different offenses. What was this guy doing? Yeah, we do. Let me tell you something. If I go to that game and I know moms, like even I have friends, even Penny Bennett, Marcella's Bennett's and, you know, their mom, she was like, I can't watch. I'm reading a book. I'm watching because afterwards, Eli, so we would talk about, you know, what happened here. Because for him, that's his love language. He's like, okay, if you're interested in it, then yeah, you're in this thing with me. We'll talk about other stuff, but we get to the football because I love to hear, okay, what did you see on this play?
Girl, he got daddy for that. No, ma'am. No, because do you know the conversations? I tell my husband this all the time. You know, Miles, we'd like to talk to you about something other than football. But that's my husband's love language with his son. Mine is not. So, you know, my love language is actually I make a point of cooking his favorite stuff that he got when he was little. So our love language is different. Girl, other than, I know football to some extent, but I can't tell you about no sweeps, no plays, no this. I don't know. All I know is when you got to the quarterback, I have to come home after every game and rewatch the game so I can watch it on the field versus watching my kid. Because I was the one, and let's not talk about this too deeply, but I was the one who said, oh my God, Miles hit him with the helmet. Because my eyes are constantly on my child.
Yeah.
I'm not watching football. I'm watching, make sure my kid is not hurt. That's how I've always watched the sports. I'm making sure my kid is not hurt. I'll go home. I go back home and immediately turn on a football game and watch the Browns at this point play again.
We'll touch on that really quickly later on, but I want to get to his sophomore year. By that time where like his body starts to fit in and he gave it all to football. And I mean, he just was kicking butt. And then by 2014, he was a five-star recruit and one of the top edge rushers. Let's talk about that recruiting process for you guys, because I know recruiting is crazy where every college around the world wants him. I read that he could have gone to Ohio State because he loved dinosaurs. And Ohio State has a great study of dinosaurs.
Yep.
How did you get that baby to not go to Ohio State and to go to Texas A&M? How did you do that? And why did you do that?
Okay. Okay, so Ohio State had a nice little push. The paleontology program was huge for him. They really didn't like come through, as in, I guess logistically, I just don't feel like he felt the love. And that paleontology thing was big. The school that had the best chance outside of A&M was TCU, which is like 10 minutes away from us. But the TCU program was just like, okay, you're the number one player in the United States is not 10 minutes away. And TCU and Ohio State were just like, maybe he'll go somewhere else.
Really?
Yes. Yeah, it was, but A&M had that secret weapon. And that secret weapon was Bria being there already. Bria and Miles were thick as thieves. That girl mothered him. That was her baby. She mothered him. So the only thing she ever said to him is, I don't care where you go. And we let them pick. We didn't try to pick their schools for them. But she said, I don't care where you go as long as it ain't Texas. That was her only rule. Don't even look down there. And ironically, the University of Texas was the first school to actually offer Miles a scholarship when he was like early junior, in between his sophomore and junior year. Honey, that Mac looked at Miles and brought him to that office and said, We're not going to approve you for recruitment. We're offering you a scholarship today. And, it was like, my husband came back home. He's like, he offered him on the spot.
But he chose Texas A&M. And where Coach Kevin Sumlin, he said, Miles Garrett marches to a different beat. And he plays that way too. So what do you think Kevin Sumlin meant by that?
He knew Miles was different from the average player just coming in. As much passion as he put on the field, he realized that Miles, he wasn't a follower, but he wasn't yet a leader, but he was still his own person. So the music that's in Miles's head is the music that he dances to. Nothing on the outside affects Miles. He does what he needs to do, but he doesn't care that you don't like dinosaurs. If that's where his passion is, he does photography. He's very artistic. So he goes to the beat of his own drum.
So where did this love of dinosaur come from? Is it Jurassic Park? Do we have Jurassic Park to blame this?
It is.
Jurassic Park had everybody.
It is.
Before Jurassic Park, I don't even think we thought about dinosaurs.
He was funny because Jurassic Park actually came out before he was born.
Yeah.
It was a movie that my husband and I both kind of liked, and we were watching it. And of course, we didn't like expose the kids to like horror movies, but the dinosaur eating the man in the toilet when he hid, yes. We didn't consider that horror. So when Miles did that, his eyes got
big. You just thought the dinosaur was really hungry. You know what I mean?
Honey, Miles is like, he ate the man.
Off the toilet.
So he was hooked. And he was like, well, when's the next one coming out? And he was a little fella. And from that point on, I would just gift him with dinosaurs. Lawrence would find him dinosaurs. Girl, he would be in the backyard digging up dinosaur bones. I mean, he was...
You guys had dinosaur bones in the backyard?
Hell no. But he would be back there thinking he was going to find a dinosaur bone in his backyard. And girl, my husband would trip in these little holes that he would dig in the backyard. And he would, Miles, come in here, fill in this hole. That baby would be outside trying to find some dinosaur bones in his backyard.
Before Audrey and I continue with this awesome conversation, I've got a special offer that I want to share with you. If you're anything like me, then you know that life gets real busy, and paying attention to ensuring you're eating healthier, wholesome options can fall by the wayside. Well, that does not have to be the case, because Green Chef can help. Green Chef is a USDA certified organic company that makes eating well so easy and affordable, with plans to fit every kind of lifestyle, which makes cooking delicious dinners at home easier than ever. There's a wide variety of recipes to choose from, and they cater to keto, paleo, and plant-based diets too. All ingredients come pre-measured, and the recipes are super easy to follow with step-by-step directions. You can't mess this up, even if you try. I tried the chicken breast. It was so awesome. Every ingredient you're going to need, you don't have to run to the store because you forgot onions. Guess what? Onions is in there. So it's awesome. If that's made you hungry for more, go to greenchef.com/wrap90 and use code WRAP90 to get $90 off, including free shipping. That's greenchef.com/wrap90 and use code WRAP90. That's the numbers 90 to get $90 off, including free shipping. Guys, you can't beat that with a bat. So Texas A&M, how did he enjoy it? I mean, he did his thing there.
He loved his time. Loved his time. Proud Aggie.
He even broke Jadeveon Clowney's record.
Yeah, his freshman year.
Like, what did you think when you would go see him play and just watch how dominant he was?
You know, we still look at each other and go, dang, that's our kid. You know, we did that. We still are in awe of when Miles does stuff. So as parents sitting there watching, it kind of takes your breath away because, you know, I've watched football since I was 11. I laugh and say I don't know anything about football, but I've watched it. I've been a diehard Cowboy fan. Like, you know, we on Sundays after church, we come home, make sure we, you know, my minister, you know, we Cowboy country here in Texas. Football is king. So he would get us out of church early enough. And
that man heard from the Lord, didn't he?
Girl, in the name of Jesus. We would come home and watch, you know, have food ready and sit down and watch the Cowboy game.
1 Corinthians, Cowboys 3, verse 39.
There you go.
We're going home.
But football was always in our house. And so it was just a natural evolution. But ironically, because Sean started playing basketball. So my husband is like this all around athlete. He played basketball, baseball, football. So the kids, the boys tried everything. I mean, when Sean started playing basketball, then like I said, Miles had this thing where I'm going to play basketball too. So actually Miles was a pretty good basketball player and he got a couple of offers from D1 schools, but we kept trying to convince him, your body type. You know, Sean is 6'8 and scrawny, thin, total the basketball package. Miles is built like his dad, who is, you know, broad shoulders. Let me put it like this. My husband looked like Miles when I met him. Yes, yes. So for all those women out there, them cougars who keep hitting me up in my inbox, my husband looked like that when we met. Yes, come through, Big Daddy. Okay, I'm sorry.
Ladies and gentlemen, Lawrence Garrett.
The muscles, girl. Yes.
Give that man his glory. Give him his shine.
That's genetic. I'm just going to let that sit there like that. Yes.
So he made it. When did you know, though, after 3 years in college, he was ready for the draft? Like, how did you guys as a family make that decision when Miles was like, I read to go?
Well, you know what? There was no place to go, but when you're number one and predicted number one, there's no place to go but up. So there was no reason for him to come back in his senior year other than to get his degree, which was important. But you don't want to take the chance of getting hurt. If you remember, he was hurt in his junior year and played on that bum leg. And so there was no need to risk it any further. And so in the process of doing this, Miles and my husband took that lead in, or actually my husband took the lead and then kind of funneled it to Miles and I. He's the one who, you know, took the brunt of talking to agents and talking to reps and talking to this and talking to that. I did it with Sean in basketball. And so he took it. Miles is his only son. And he took the lead on that in the most protective way to protect his son from all the junk that is out there that comes through when your kid is at that level, getting ready to go to that next phase in life. And he and Miles just kept talking and really there was nowhere to go but into the next phase when you're predicted to be number one. If he had been lower ranked, he might have come back. He could have healed from the injury. And I mean, just he did in his rookie year with the Browns. It just took time for it to heal. But it made no sense for him to stay an extra year.
Now, let me ask you this, because I know I have these conversations with other moms, and especially, you know, I talked to Cheryl Boza before, and her thing was she used to always tell boys, if you get hurt out there, I'm going to kill you. Because, you know, she would get so worked up because you don't want to see your kids injured.
It. Right.
So many people ask us, like, how do you deal with, because injury is part of the game. How were you as a family able to handle that injury in college before we even get to the pros?
Well, you know, it actually pissed me off in college, you know, having been a collegiate athlete and having a couple of kids before Miles go through the process. Collegiately, how they handle your kid when they're hurt pisses me off.
Girl.
And I love some A&M. That's unequivocal. But their job is to make sure that they have a winning product on the field. And it's the same way in the NFL. It's just at a higher level. If they can shoot you up with cortisone or whatever it is to get you back on that field. When we got the review of Miles's injury, he should never have played. That bone bruise was deep. It took months and months to properly heal. It didn't take a lot for us to go, okay, no, we're going to jump onto the next level, because that injury, it would have been better, they said, if he had broken it. If he had broken his leg, it would have taken a shorter time to heal than what he did. And putting you out there on the field and throwing these kids out there in the field, I say this all the time. What people don't realize is your son, Eli, and Miles, and Joey Bosa, and all those kids, they're one in a million shot. And so most kids are not going to graduate from college, I hate to say it, athletically. And the injuries they come out with are lifelong in some respects. They're not prepared for that exit point when the collegiate days are over and I don't go pro. There are only so many spots on the team. And, you know, your chance of making it is limited. So it is incumbent upon you to first stress academics and get your degree and then work with if I make it. That should be your plan B, if I make it. Get your degree first. As the university, they're concerned about the money that they're getting off of these athletes.
And that was my concern with college football during this pandemic. Already, normally with college football, transparency when it comes to safety and health issues is non-existent, right?
Correct.
I know one great advice that my friend Betty Roby gave me, Brad Roby's mom, because, you know, they all went to Ohio State, was that after every offseason, she was like, make sure you get your kid an MRI. Get that full body MRI, because the team will not, I mean, it's the nature of the game to not be honest
yes.
with you. You know, it's a shame when I could tell you horror stories of people that I know, because why? They just want to get you out there.
Right.
You know, and that's why for me, playing during a pandemic, I was like, we can't guarantee these kids' safety any other day. But now we're adding this whole factor to it. So that was my huge issue with it.
Well, you know, and this coronavirus affects your lungs.
And your heart.
Your heart, exactly. Even if you're a prime athlete, you know, even if you're a prime athlete, you have testimonies where people are talking online where I'm a marathon runner and I can't walk, you know, up my stairs or through my house without resting now. What if it happens to one of these collegiate athletes, you know, and you have to be proactive in your care with your kid up until the time they're pro. And even once they're in the leagues, it is incumbent upon you got your own insurance. You got your own coins. Go get your MRI done. Another thing, and this is kind of off topic, but on topic, once you retire, what a lot of these athletes don't realize is you've worked in every state. I have a friend of mine, and I won't call his name, but I have a friend of mine played in the NFL. When he retired, he actually lives in Texas, but he gets his disability benefits out of California because they pay more. They don't let you know that because they tax you in that state, you work in that state.
Come on. Now, that's good information.
Huh? They don't tell you that part. And so you need to go and find where you're getting the most out of your disability benefits to get your care.
Wow. That is important.
There's a lot of little secret nuances of this system that once you leave, it makes no sense that, I mean, I know we're talking about raising a pro, but the pro ends up.
No, but that's the process. It's the process.
A process. Yes. And when you walk away from the game, you're walking away with injuries. That's why you can't tell me my child don't make enough money. I don't care what his contract says. It's a lifelong. What you were entertained by is the physicality of it. Well, he suffers the repercussions of the physicality. So the coins that he makes right now, until the owner has the inability to pay him, don't fuss with me about the man who's making the money. Fuss about the wealth of the man who could pay the money.
And that's why for me, I've always been pushing for years now to get college football players paid. You have coaches making millions on top of millions on top of millions, and you have kids being paid nothing. So that's a whole nother issue. And then they still get the injury.
What pisses me off is the coach can leave and go to another school, leave those kids high and dry. He can take that job, start coaching immediately. And yet my kid has to sit here and sit out a year
because he wants to twist schools, or the coaches can block him from going to a school in the same division. What kind of but I can't block you from going and getting a coaching job in the same division. I can't block you from doing this.
My thing is pay the kids, because pay, like you kids. Said, it's only one in a million. So all those kids on that team, on that roster, maybe three of them are going to make it to the NFL. So you have the rest of them. They still have the same injuries.
Correct.
And many of them can't get health insurance afterward because they have pre-existing issues. I mean, we could go over here all day.
Yes.
So let's get out of, let's get ready for the draft, yes. Right? When he came out, you know, you got to love the media because everybody got an opinion. And one of the opinions I have to read is from not one of my favorite at all. Don't really care for him, but I'm sure his mama loves him and so does Jesus. Hall of Famer Warren Sapp said, I see a lazy kid that makes four plays a game. This is your number one guy. That's just one example of the shade and all of that stuff. But how did you guys, you know, you're leaving Texas A&M, coming into the pros. How were you guys prepared to handle the media and all of the stuff and projections and antagonism? Because I don't call it analysis, because you because most of what they do is antagonizing. So how were you guys able to handle that?
Girl, if the audience could only see my face, because you can. I'm going to visit this Warren Sapp thing one more time. Let me tell you something. Everybody's not going to like your kid coming out.
And that's okay.
And that's okay. And it's just the nature of the beast, whether they don't like him because they didn't go to his school or he didn't go to their school or he didn't get drafted to their team. I got you. But when you have the gall to sit there and attack lazy, is a character issue.
That's what I'm saying. It's not analysis. It's antagonizing.
Annie Apple, that's not the conversation that you want to have with me about Warren Sapp, because I'm going to take
umbrage. We go there. This is raising a pro. We go there. And when you come for our kids, you come for us.
Yeah, Warren need to leave me alone. One of his friends told me, I'm not going to mention his name either because I don't throw people under the bus. But he said, I told Warren not to say nothing else. I said, good. I said, because I lay off when he lay off. But him and Booger McFarland, yeah, I throw them too. Gobba gobba, gobba gobba juice. That's my version of cursing on the air. So don't come for my kid. Personally, you can critique his performance. You can critique, but character-wise, if you don't know him, don't speak on it. I promise you, Miles ain't got nothing for Booger and he ain't got nothing for Warren. So Warren needs to concern himself about them prostitutes and worry about what his kids are doing. Don't worry about mine. Mine is going to be just fine.
And you know, as somebody who actually, you know, is a trained journalist who actually, you know, when you get on TV and when you make an assessment and, you know, provide analysis. But I think for me, the most frustrating and sad thing about sports journalism now is a lot of former players who feel like for them to earn a check, that means they have to keep their foot on somebody else's neck. Oh, that rhymes. Yes. I wasn't even trying to make it rhyme, but it's just, it's unnecessary for them to get a check. They got to keep a foot on. No, you don't need to do that.
Yes.
When you assassinate somebody's character, that's not analysis anymore. But it's like, they think that's entertainment.
Correct. This thing of what now you could sit behind a keyboard and really try to slaughter somebody's character. If I read one more time that, you know, Miles tried to commit murder.
Oh, my goodness. We'll get to that.
Yes,
but now we're going to enjoy his draft day.
Amen.
What was that day like when?
We had so many surprises for him, you know, because I'd already done a draft day. It was nothing, you know, I hate to say it was nothing new, but we had surprises for Miles.
Excuse me. Don't be trying to compare new NBA draft day with the NFL draft day, because nobody does draft like the NFL. I would tell you.
Well, but we did private parties for both boys.
I'm talking about watching him walk up there as the number one.
He didn't walk up there.
That's right. You guys did it at home.
Yeah, we did private.
Oh my God. I totally forgot. You guys did it at home. Now tell me about that. Why did you choose to do it at home?
He wanted to do it at home. He wanted all his friends and family that had supported him, that he was close to. He wanted coaches to be able to come. He wanted the people who loved him and supported him from the time he was playing, you know, to be able to enjoy the moment. And girl, when I tell you the NFL put on the blitz trying to get us, well, we'll put you in this kind of dress. We'll get you diamonds from here. We'll do this and put y'all up here. Girl, we had offers, baby.
Wait, hold. The NFL was promising y'all diamonds?
Let's not to keep.
To borrow?
To borrow. And,
let me go call Roger. Kind of
Girl, well, maybe I won't say who the representative was, but they pulled out the stops to try to get us to convince, what, to get me to convince Miles. And I kept saying no.
Because it's not your choice. It's Miles.
It was Miles' choice. And we were going to support whatever. That's the thing, we just supported whatever the kids, you know, wanted. If it was in reason, it was not about us. And my husband and I have always said it's not about us. So draft day comes. We had Randy Moss. We had a friend who knew Randy. I knew Bruce Smith. So I had contacted some friends, you know, and Miles's agent worked it all out for us. So Miles knew nobody was coming. He knew we were going to have TV there, you know, so he was prepared for the interviews that, you know, and the stuff that was in the house. When Randy Moss, he was upstairs trying to get ready, and Randy comes to the house. And baby, that Randy Moss and his fine self talking about, hey, little lady, girl, I'd never forget that. Anyway, that joker right there.
He has good skin. He has good skin.
Vapors. Okay. So, you know, I said, Miles, you need to come down. They need to re-record some stuff. And Miles is like kind of frustrated. He wants to get ready. And there's Randy Moss standing in the door. Randy is Miles' favorite player.
Wow.
When he was growing up, he got Randy Moss jerseys. And so that tickled Miles. He had already done, you know, the stuff with Bruce. And we wanted Bruce because Bruce plays his position. And they sat down in the living room and Bruce really talked to him and mentored him. They still have great communication with each other. But Randy was the icing on the cake. And then Randy ended up doing it for, I think he does the NFL Today show. So he ended up being at the draft party doing the NFL. We were very judicious about the ESPNs and the NFL Network and stuff, they wanted to be there and do it exclusively. But we were like, no, we have to have some of our local press in here. So we had Babe Laufenberg, who was local, former quarterback for the Cowboys. We had local press. Pat Doney was in. I mean, we wanted to include those people who had covered Miles when he was young. So we rented out this great facility. Miles had a blast. And it was a party. It was a celebration. And so by the time they called his name, Miles knew they were going to call his name. We did not. So the expression that my husband and I have is we're sitting there like, they did call his name, you know, because it went back and forth. But Miles knew that because he had prepared with that shirt under his, you know, the Cleveland shirt under the shirt he had on. But he held his tongue. He did not even tell his dad and I. So those expressions that we had when you see that camera, those are legit expressions. We were surprised.
So Miles became the highest draft pick out of Texas A&M, right?
Yes.
But his injury caused him, you know, and he even went to training camp, did well for the Browns, but his injury kind of kept him out the start of the year. He comes, he's just balling. He's ferocious. Let's skip forward to that big game where things kind of got out of control for Miles. It was November 14, 2019, and a fight erupted on the field during the Steelers and Browns game. Miles had an altercation with Steelers quarterback Mason Rudolph, which resulted in Miles swinging his helmet. And I don't know if it directly made contact on Rudolph's head, but it was a very dramatic scene that only took minutes, but it seemed like forever. Were you at the game and what did you see?
We go to almost every game. My husband has not missed a game in the pros, and we only missed one in college because Miles was injured and not supposed to play. So that night, you know, we're sitting in our seats. And of course, like I said, I'm watching him. And it was like, I said, Lawrence, Miles is fighting. And then I said, oh my God, he hit him with the helmet. What the hell? You know, mm-hmm. And so, because that is completely, as we say, out of character. You know, Miles is that kid who doesn't want to kill a bug. He still won't kill. He'll call his friends in, you know, who stays with him in Cleveland, like, man, get this out of my room. You know, he's a very gentle person. And, you know, at his house in Cleveland, he has wildlife that comes in his backyard and he feeds it in the deer feeder. And so he's out here providing for wild animals. For him to have that level of aggression, it was like, okay, something went down. And so he was, you know, escorted off the field, and, you know, we go to where we can get to the families can go, and we're waiting. And usually it takes about 45 minutes to an hour. We were waiting almost 2 hours. And I had ridden with him that night. It was four of us. He finally makes it out. We get in the car and he's still smoking. I mean, he's just, like I said, he doesn't talk until he's ready. And I said, okay, son, what happened? And he said, he called me the N-word. He said,
he told you that same night.
That same night. in the car, and he was more descriptive, and he was more concerned about the fact that he was cussing in front of me than saying, because we don't use the N-word in my house. I have friends and family members that use it, and I have two children that use it. But my husband and I, we don't say that word. So Miles is not a person that uses the word either. And so I was like, oh, well, you should have bashed him to the white meat. So, like I said, my inside voice came out to play. Because while I'm sitting there for them 2 hours, I'm sitting there going, oh my God, I hope Mason Rudolph is okay. Lord, should I reach out to his mother? Because if that was my son, you know, should I reach out as a mother to another mother? Because that could have hurt her son. You know, the compassion of me as a mother had kicked in because, mind you, I hadn't heard from my child yet. And I'm thinking, Lord have mercy. You know, that was this is this woman's child. You know, the mother part kicks in. But when you come out your mouth as a white man and call my son the N-word, you get what you get. So for all those people who are running around talking about my child committed murder, after seeing, because mind you, we hadn't seen the replay the way we're in the moment in the heat. As I sit and watch, for those people who want to say my child was a thug and a murderer, attempted murder and so forth, what you got was a person who aggressively attacked my child. My child got the best of him. His teammates came in between my child and his assailant, and his assailant kept pushing. And when he came for it, my child protected himself by any means necessary. Do I agree with the fact that he hit him with the helmet? No, but it was the weapon. It was the weapon that was in his hand to protect himself in the moment. So you can't come for me and my child talking about he was the aggressor. He was never the aggressor in the situation. Mason Rudolph was. Mason Rudolph was the assailant. My child was the victim.
When I watched it, I was just like, something else happened here because that doesn't make any sense.
Right.
I just knew from not even knowing Miles personally, but I just, you know, I just always just loved his personality. I will follow different things, you know, online that he would do, whether it's poetry, whether it's helping communities get clean water. So I followed him as far as his activities in the community. And as a mom, it kicks in for me because it's like, no, this is not in his character. And so, you right. know, the media blew it. It was the craziest thing. And being a journalist, you always have to be, you have to be measured in a sense of, get all the information before you open your mouth. I know nowadays people just want to be first, or they just want to be the loudest, or they just want to be, you know, just throw anything out there and see what sticks.
Right.
And I could understand people like, oh, he's lying. It wasn't any racial war. And we're going to fast forward to the racial injustices, the things that we're seeing right now in the last few months that we never thought we would really see, although we knew as Black people that this happens. But my thing was, if he said it, it happened.
You can. Well, first of all, I don't. And this gets tricky because, you know, this is the employer of our sons, but there are parabolic mics anywhere. For them to say, we didn't hear anything on the mics, on the recordings, to justify what was done. If there's nothing, release the tapes and it proves Mason. They didn't release the tapes at all. If there's nothing to be said, release the tapes.
Were there tapes?
Yeah, there are parabolic mics everywhere. And Mason Rudolph actually had the thing on his head, on his helmet, to indicate he was mic'd up that night. So if there's nothing to be heard, then make Miles out the liar that they say he is.
For our sons, they're so used to absorbing pain and absorbing hits that they don't really come out and they don't even tell you when they're injured. They don't even tell you when they're hurt physically or emotionally. So it's not something you're going to get, like, he's not going to run and say, oh, he did this to me, because there are coaches who are verbally abusive. They're like, they are used to being in this space where people sanction abuse, whether it's physically or emotionally. So when people are like, well, why didn't he say it at first? Or why didn't he say it here? Why didn't he say it?
He did. He was counseled in the car, in the vehicle, not to say, and his agent told him, Bus Cook, he said, we're not going to turn this into a racial situation. Let's talk to the NFL. I was in the car. I felt like, you know, because there were another person in the car and they were like, oh, we got to put out a statement. No. Let's be quiet. Because what you don't want to do was turn this into a racial situation, because it was, you know, we're already in a bat crap crazy situation. And the first thing they always want to say is Black people want to, you know, pull the race card. He was advised not to say anything anything. And so the weeks went on. When he made his comments in the hearing, it was supposed to be private. It was never the intent of his team to put it out there. He thought he was in a safe space where he could say, look, man, this is what happened, because he told us immediately. We knew what happened. And so for them, the people to come out, oh, now you want to play the race card. You didn't have time to think about it.
Exactly.
That is not what happened. He was advised not to say anything. He was now being called a liar, a violent liar. He was being, I mean, when people attack your family member, especially your children, and you know the character of the person that you're dealing with, I'm not that mother who says, oh, my child wouldn't do this. Oh, my child, honey, I know who his mom and daddy are. I specifically know his mother. His mother would have hit him, and not just hit him once. She'd have hit him twice. You got your dad, his daddy's side, where you probably just got that one lick. I'd have been swinging for the white meat. So it's one thing to say, you know, that was a bad act. It was. Oh, my God. As a mother, and knowing that that was somebody's child and the damage that could have been done, it still bothers me. But if you haven't taught your child any better than to open his mouth and the real person comes out, you know, as Black people, we have to think our thoughts in our head and hold our tongue. And we have practice for it from the time we're little, that we have to hold our tongue about things that are done and said to us, because it jeopardizes our lives. And white people don't raise their children like that. They get to say whatever the hell comes to their mind at that time. And in a stressful situation, Mason Rudolph's true personality came out. He said what he said, and he got the repercussions of what was said. Miles would not have hit him if he hadn't come charging at him the second time around. They were separated. Here he comes aggressively running. What were you going to do when you got there? Were you searching for your helmet as you were charging him with that anger on your face? The camera doesn't lie. So what were you coming to do? Get your helmet? I mean, your teammates were blocking him. And don't get me, while you started on how Miles hit Rudolph in the head, how about Maurice Pouncey kicking my child in the head? So what's the difference between a kick and a swing of the helmet? You're kicking him in the head. And they reduced his penalty. Annie.
First of all, when people say race card, I'm a Black woman. I don't have to use a race card. Everywhere I go, my color gets there before I even get there. That's the first thing people see. And that's it's true. Like before you spend your life trying to prove that I'm worthy of your respect and my humanity is worthy, instead of me just being worthy because I am a God creation.
Right.
How was Miles, you know, the days and weeks after that?
He's so introspective. He internalizes. So the person who really he talked to a lot, and Lawrence talked, is my husband. My husband talked to his son. And I try not to insert myself in their private men's conversations, because that is an experience as one Black man to another Black man that I don't have any insight. Mine is definitely outside looking in. So they could talk to each other as Black men together. And you know, my husband is a voice of reason, and he really talks to his son in many instances about having integrity and keeping your head up. You know what was said, walking your truth kind of thing. For me, I was always concerned about the mental. How are you dealing with this? Miles wasn't that kid or man. Let me stop calling my son a kid, because he's always going to be my kid. He's not a man who's going to hide his head in the sand. He still got out of his house, went to the store. He had nothing to be ashamed about, in the sense that he protected himself. Was he proud of the act itself? No, that's not something he ever walked around. I hit a man in his head. That's not how he was raised or a thought process he should have. But he was not going to walk around in shame, as in he was not going to not be truthful about what went on. He was always going to be truthful and tell the truth.
How were you able to support him, even with everything that was happening around, all the media, everybody? And what was your biggest concern?
Well, you know what? Once we got the decision that he was going to be suspended, we had talked about it. Everybody voiced their opinion. Everybody said, you know, what they needed to say as far as our family was concerned. And we were just moving forward to make sure that Miles was mentally and physically strong. Okay, then dedicate your time to getting bigger, stronger, losing the weight you want to lose. We moved to the next level. There was nothing after the appeal was denied. You know, we were gonna have to sit out the appeal. Life went on for us because the truth set you free. The beat of our rhythm never stopped. It was what it was. We had so much support locally here in the Arlington area, in the DFW area, the Aggie family. You know, those people who knew Miles, those who people who were impacted, the Cleveland community was beautiful. People from all over found a way to contact us, whether it was social media. And Annie, quite frankly, this is the first time I've ever spoken in an interview about this the whole time. I have kept my own counsel. I've said it, you know, just kind of kept to myself, and my husband and I, we don't talk about it. We've moved on as a family unit. And if it's not asked of me, I won't even speak of it, because as far as I'm concerned, it's a done deal issue. It should not, none of our individual moments should define us in the totality of who we are. If you are a drunk driver and you happen to get in an accident, that's not the totality of who you are as a person. We all have our moments, situations that happen. That's a God plan. It's not our plan. So you have to either learn from those moments, turn those moments into teachable moments, and not let any individual moment completely determine who you are as a person. And when Miles speaks to people, he speaks to people in teachable moments. And that's something that my husband and I have always done, is we try to get our children to understand there are teachable moments and to utilize each moment that you come across in a teachable effort for somebody else.
You know, and in closing, if I had to just ask you a question, whether your kid plays football, plays a piano, or grows up to be an accountant, what's the one advice that you would give to parents in just the whole journey of walking a kid into his or her purpose?
Support. I think the biggest thing we ever did for our kids was support. When each of the kids were in the midst of their chosen sports fields, the one thing we never said is we're going to see Sean play basketball. We're going to see Bria cheer. We're going to see Bria throw. What we did say was we've got to go support them. It was never about them playing. It was supporting them. Being present, we're now supporting Miles in football. When Miles leaves football, we'll support them there. So just be present in your kids' lives and support their choices and be willing to give your child some hard answers. And don't tiptoe around when they're not doing things you can't support. Your support can be non-support. It can be, I can't support you sitting around the house acting like this. You're going to have to man up, gird up your loins, and go find something else to do. But that's supporting, because you're pushing them from behind to move forward. You got to be pushing them forward.
Support is so important. What wisdom. And Audrey is also correct. We cannot allow one flawed moment to define us. And we must use those moments as teachable moments and remember the importance of living in truth. As I reflect on my conversation with Audrey, I was struck by her recollection of Miles sharing that Mason Rudolph, a white player, had used the N-word. When he told this to everyone in the car, including his white agent, the agent's response was, we don't want to make this a racial thing. Or as some would say, we don't want to play the race card. Which leads me to today's Annie's Clapback. As a Black woman, it's interesting to me when people say, someone is playing the race card. It always takes me back, because it's like, race card? My color is a covering, not a card. And playing the race card insinuates that I have an advantage. Where and when in this country has a Black skin been a valued advantage? Also, race card indicates that I have the power to control how my color is perceived and received. I don't. So when our kids say they've experienced racism, whether on the football field, at the store, in class, or in an apartment building, just listen and empathize. That's what makes you a great ally. Thanks so much for listening. Raising a Pro is part of the Audio Boom Original Network. And if you like the show, then make sure you rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. Take time.
time to rate and review. Rent is really high in Los Angeles, and I'm a big girl, so I need to eat. Anyway, follow us on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to drop me a line or suggest someone you'd like to hear from on the series, find me on socials at Raising a Pro. Just one more week, and I'll be right back for another peek behind the heart of the gridiron. See you next time, family.